Welcome to the seminar on racism and sexism. Not kidding. It might sound funny, but it's really very serious because the critics of capitalism accuse the market of being in bed with or part of or intimately connected to racism and sexism. They think that deep within the bowels of economics is prejudice against blacks, women, homosexuals, whoever it is. And I think that this charge needs to be dealt with, needs to be considered very carefully, because it's a very serious charge indeed. And the way I'd like to start off is by just reviewing what marginal revenue product is. Marginal revenue product is the change in total product when one more worker is hired. So the marginal revenue product of the X worker is the total revenue product of X workers minus the total revenue product of X minus one workers. Or to put this in English, to use numbers, the total revenue product of 101 workers, you subtract the total revenue product of 100 workers, and there you get the marginal contribution of the 101st worker. So I'm assuming that there was $10,000 that all the workers produced, then we hired one more worker, and the total revenue of the firm went up to $10,005, and I attribute the change to the 101st worker, and I say that that is the 101st worker's marginal revenue product, or productivity. Now, there are three possibilities with regard to wages and marginal revenue productivity. One is that the wage will be higher than the marginal productivity, for example, 7, and the productivity of the worker is 5, and that is not a real good bet, because a firm that's paying its workers more than it's getting is going to go broke. On the other hand, if it pays its workers below their productivity is, they will quit and look for other jobs where they can get more money. Or if somehow an employer succeeds in paying a worker $2 for a contribution of $5, some other employer will bid it up to $201 or $202 or $203, and eventually it'll get up toward $5. So we economists, and this isn't just Austrians, but pretty much all economists except Marxian economists, which I guess is a contradiction in terms, believe in the marginal revenue product theory of wage determination, that wages are dependent upon productivity. What in turn determines productivity? Well, pretty much how hard the workers work, how smart they are, how much training they have, how much capital equipment they have, which in turn depends upon economic freedom. The more economic freedom, the more of all these things you'll have and the more productivity. Okay, so that's just sort of a brief review. Let me now introduce racism, and I'll consider most of the time on sexism, prejudice against females, but I want to talk a little bit about racism. There are two kinds of things that sort of go under the general heading of racism. One of them is just in broad empirical generalizations, which happen to be true. For example, Walter Williams, a very famous black economist, poses the following problem. He says, suppose you go to a university like Auburn University, and I will give you $500, and you can give $500 to whoever you succeed in getting, if you succeed, in finding someone who can, one, dunk a basketball, and two, solve a quadratic equation. But you can't ask them anything. All you can do is pick one person out of the masses of Auburn students. And Walter Williams said, well, if you use broad empirical generalizations or induction, you'd be very wise to go to a black male and say, I'll give you $100 if you can dunk a basketball. On the other hand, you would be very wise to go to some sort of nerdy looking, maybe Oriental kid with a pocket protector and big glasses and say, I'll give you $500 or I'll give you some of the money if you can solve a quadratic equation. Whereas suppose you do it the other way around, Walter Williams says you're probably not going to win the bet based on broad empirical generalizations. And indeed, there's nothing wrong with this. It's just a matter of using common sense or prejudice, sometimes called prejudice, but it just means prejudging based on past history. And I think it's a reasonable bet to bet that some black kid can dunk the basketball and some Oriental with thick glasses can solve the quadratic equation. And if this be racism, well, so much the worse. So that's just common sense. Another example Walter Williams offers is he says, suppose you go into a room and you see a tiger sitting on the couch. Now what do? You have two courses of action. One, you could be prejudiced against tigers and close the door and sort of hold the door there and call the cops or the animal control people. Or you can be unprejudiced, don't prejudge tigers, this tiger by previous tiger behavior, and go up to the tiger and say, hey, what's happening, tiger? How's it shaking? And, you know, try to give him a high five or, you know, ask him, are you vicious? You know, just because every other tiger I've ever met will bite me, maybe this tiger won't. Well, if this is racism, this is just the word for empirical evidence. Or, to get back to what I was talking about, to make the claim that blacks have a lower productivity than whites, on average. And there are various theories as to why this should be. People on the left say, well, it's racism or a vestige of slavery. Charles Murray might say it's based on IQ. But I'm not interested in why it is. I'm just interested in saying that on average, black teenagers say, or blacks on average, have lower productivity. That's why they have lower wages, not because of prejudice and discrimination or anything like that. Let me introduce you to another table relating the minimum wage law. Let me put this over here. Here is a, you can see the minimum wage law. Can you see it clearly? Well, that's about as good as I can get it. The minimum wage law rises in a stepwise function. And then we have unemployment rates of non-white teenagers, which is very much higher than unemployment rates of white teenagers. And the question is, why should this be? Well, the reason is that if you have a minimum wage above productivity levels, you'll have unemployment. If a person has a $5 an hour productivity level and the minimum wage is $7 an hour, you lose $2 an hour if you hire such a person. And the reason that we have higher unemployment rates for blacks than whites, one reason is because of the fact that white kids have a higher productivity level than black kids. But there is something else, and that is real racism or real preferences. And the way Walter Williams addresses that one is he says, when I decided to get married, I immediately eliminated half the human race as a possible marriage partner. He was a heterosexual, so he didn't want to marry any man. So immediately he reduced half the human race, was out of there. Then what he did is he wanted to marry a black girl. So he engaged in his preference for black women, and he immediately put to the side all white women and Oriental women and other women. And he was engaging in racial prejudice of a different kind, namely selecting, engaging in preferences. He also has other preferences besides sex and race, namely he wanted an attractive woman who had a sense of humor, who was bright. So the man is not only a racist and a sexist, but a lookist and a smartist. And, you know, he's really a bad guy. We ought to put him in jail maybe. No, I'm kidding. Not. You see, most people, when they think of racial prejudice, they think of hanging black people. And now that's obviously a different kind of racism than making an empirical generalization on the one hand or engaging in preferences on the other hand. It's very different than those two things. And we really need different language for all these things because they're so different. In nature, the skunk is a very weak animal. And if it didn't have its special smell, it would probably go extinct. Similarly, the porcupine, if it didn't have its quills, you know, think of two porcupines mating. They got to be very careful as how they get together. But if it weren't for those quills, the porcupine would go extinct. Similarly, the deer is a very weak animal, except that it's fleet of foot. So each animal in the animal kingdom has some sort of compensating differential that it can overcome what would otherwise be considered a very serious weakness. Well, so is it in economics with regard to racial prejudice of the preference type on the idea is that if the employer doesn't want to hire blacks, this isn't hanging them. It's not just making an empirical generalization. It's engaging in a certain taste. Well, blacks have a compensating differential just like the skunk, porcupine, and deer. And what is their compensating differential? The ability to work for lower wages. So if employers were racist and wanted to engage in a preference against blacks, and blacks had a lower wage, lower than their marginal revenue productivity, if you hired a black, you would make more profits on him. You get it? And then you would be able to drive out the out of business your competitors who were prejudiced against blacks. So this is why I say that on the free market, you don't have any racial preferences in effect, because it tends to get driven out of the market. Those who engage in it, whether against women or blacks, it doesn't matter, pay more for workers than those who only are prejudiced in favor of green as in money. So if you have a white and a black kid and they have equal productivity, and the wage of the black is $3 an hour and the wage of the white is $4 an hour, if you hire only whites, you pay your labor force $4 an hour, your competitor pays only $3 an hour, he'll be able to underprice you and drive you out of the market. So racial or sexual or any kind of discrimination does not long endure in the market. Now, this is on the part of employers. There are three sorts of racial or sexual discrimination that are possible in the labor market. One is on the part of the employer, and I hope I've convinced you that any incipient tendency for employer discrimination will vanish, unless there's a minimum wage law. Now, if there's a minimum wage law, then you have discrimination on the cheap. Then there are no penalties. In other words, if you have to pay more than a certain amount, and what you do is you take away the smell of the skunk or the quills of the porcupine or the fleetness of the deer or the ability of black teenagers to work for a lower wage, then it doesn't work. So it's only on the free enterprise system that discrimination of this sort is eradicated. Okay, so much for employer discrimination. Employee discrimination is one group of employees hates the other group of employees. Say whites and Orientals hate each other, or blacks and whites, or whites and blacks, or whatever. The answer there is not unemployment or discrimination on the form of wages, rather it's segregation in the labor force. For example, if I'm an employer and I have whites and Orientals who hate each other, and when they get near each other they fight, which reduces their productivity. What I do is I keep them separate. I have let's say I'm building houses. So in this development, the one group builds the houses and not the other. In this group of houses, the other guy does it. Or I have separate parts of the factory. The third one is customer discrimination. Here's this idea of Walter Williams being the customer and trying to find a wife in the marriage market. Well, that is harder to dissipate. And that can last, and in the market you might have different groups of people being voluntarily segregated. I, as a person of the Jewish faith, I'm not practicing, but I am ethnically Jewish. When and if Hitler comes back, the fact that I'm not a practicing Jew won't matter. There were cases where Jews were not allowed before the anti-discrimination laws? And the answer is, well, if we're not allowed, then we'll pay more, and it'll pay for someone else, whether Jewish or not, to set up a restaurant or a golf club or what have you. So I think that minorities need not fear the market. There are sources that will come to their rescue, as long as you don't have things like minimum wage law to interfere with this process. Okay, that's all I'm going to say about racism. Let me now talk a little bit about sexism. And I'm going to deal with two issues. Why is there a male-female wage gap, which is attributed to prejudice against women and capitalists being evil? And then also I'll talk about the glass ceiling. Why is it that there are so few women in top CEOs or top politicians or in physics or math, the issue over which Larry Summers, the president of Harvard, got in trouble for discussing previously. Okay, well, here is the case in cartoons, as is my wont, to illustrate the feminist or the left feminist view on discrimination. And there is a boy baby and a girl baby, and they're looking into their diapers, and they're saying that the plumbing pretty much explains the discrimination. So this is sort of a feminist kind of a cartoon indicating that the reason females are paid less is that the market or employers hate women or deprecate their contributions or diminish them or what have you. Sort of puzzling, because the idea is that most employers are white and male, and somehow they hate females. I mean, the males that I know don't hate females. The very opposite is the case, but what do I know? Here's another cartoon that sort of indicates it. It's not as funny, but what the heck. Use what we can get. And it says, I feel like a man trapped in a woman's salary because he's making less money. So the idea is that there's something endemic in markets that lowers female wages. And this guy, I guess, is getting in touch with his feminine side. Okay, now there are two theories as to why females earn less than males. And before I get into the theories, let me agree with the claim that indeed females do make less than males on the market. So I'm not denying that. One of the explanations of this, whether it's for whites or blacks, it doesn't matter. First, I'll illustrate the one for blacks. Namely, you have a... here is the demand based on marginal revenue product with no discrimination. And now we are discriminating against black laborers. So the wages of blacks goes down. And it's the same thing for males and females. Here is the demand curve if there's no discrimination. Here is the supply curve. Here is the demand curve if there is discrimination. So marginal revenue product only determines things roughly, and then you add discrimination or non-discrimination to the mix to determine if males or females get less money. Okay, so those are the two theories. Let me give some quotes from people. Here's a quote from a feminist. Jobs held by women are valued less than those held by men, which accounts for the wage gap. A typical sort of a claim. And then they'll give you all sorts of statistics to buttress this. Women with a university degree earn just $1,600 a year more than men with a high school education. A working woman who graduated from university earned just $4,000 more than men with less than grade 9 schooling. And these statistics go on and on explaining what is going on here. And I agree that women do make less than men. Here are some statistics on, these are historical statistics from the statistical abstract in the 80s and early 90s. And the statistics are median weekly earnings full-time. You can see female to male, it's in the 60% level, and then it gets up to about 75%. Black-white is about the same, only it's more stable. It's around 75%, 78%. So there is a wage gap of some 25%, depending upon the year and depending upon whatever else you hold constant. And the shift demand curve is the theoretical way to explain it, and the statistics do bear it out that women earn less than men, and blacks earn less than white. And now there are two theories. One theory is that it's racial or sexual discrimination. The other theory is that it's not. Rather, it's differences in marginal revenue product. And remember, we started off the hour by saying that marginal revenue product is what determines wage rates. So if blacks have lower productivity than whites, or females have lower productivity than males, well, that would account for the wage gap without any discrimination needed to account for it. So as I say, I'm going to pretty much stick to male-female. And I want to offer you reasons for thinking that females, on average, have lower productivities than men. Why is it? Are women inferior? Well, in the 19th century, they probably were inferior in terms of productivity, because men are stronger than women, have more upper body strength, stronger legs. And when a lot of jobs were in the mines and in the factories and cutting down trees and pushing horses around, it doesn't take any great thinking to think that men would be more productive, because they are bigger and stronger and fatter and meaner, and they can push horses and cows around better than women. So in the 19th century, we would expect, even without any anything, that for there to be some gap indicating by the productivity. But now in the 20th century and in the 21st century, where most of these jobs are done by a button or a lever or from the cab of a truck or a combine, and many, many more jobs are brain jobs and not brawn jobs, the differential would just about disappear. And I would expect that in a full free market system, on average, men and women would be equally productive. How then do I explain this wage gap, which persists even to the 20th and the 21st century? The way I explain it is that, well, what's your name?
Jay.
Suppose Jay and I have the same time for the quarter mile. We can each run it in 55 seconds. Pretty good time for high school runners. Not good for Olympics. You've got to go 45 seconds. So Jay and I line up. We line up at the starting line. And just as we get ready to put the gun on, I put a 50-pound sack on his back. Who's going to win the race, given that both of our personal best times is 55 seconds? I'm going to kill him, right? Because I'll just run my usual 55, and he'll chug around with a 50-pound sack. And if he can do it in under 2 minutes, he's pretty good. My claim is that most women have, in effect, a 50-pound sack on their back, and that's why, on average, their productivity is lower than men. And what does this 50-pound sack consist of? It consists of marriage. This is the marriage asymmetry hypothesis, that marriage enhances male productivity in the market and reduces female productivity in the market. Now, let me take a little survey. If you're married, answer me on the basis of your own marriage. If you're not married, answer this survey on the basis of the marriage with which you're most knowledgeable about, probably your parents' marriage, or if you live with your uncle and your aunt, then their marriage, any one marriage that you're most familiar with. And here are three choices. With regard to housework, child rearing, doing errands, shopping, gardening, getting up in the middle of the night to take care of the kids, all those cooking, cleaning, doing laundry, doing the dishes, all of those tasks. The first choice is this is done equally between husband and wife. How many say that that's true of the marriage that they're now thinking about? Got one liar there. Three liars. How many say that the husband does more than the wife? Zero. How many say that the wife does more than the husband? Obviously. Truth tellers here. And these two are married, and they're still lying through their teeth. I know why he's raising his hand. he doesn't want to get in trouble. You don't have kids yet.
No, we don't.
Just wait. Just wait and see who gets up at 3 in the morning. And I'm not talking about just breastfeeding, which obviously, you know, only one can do. I'm talking about everything else. I mean, when my wife and I had our first kid, she wouldn't let me near the baby. I mean, her instinctual attachment or attraction to the baby was amazing. I mean, I like kids. I hug them and kiss them, but her attachment to our children was vastly superior to mine. She, you know, sort of shunted me aside. Okay, so the point is, opportunity cost is a basic element of Austrian economics. It should be of all economics, but at least it's of Austrian economics. Look, if you want to be a concert violinist, what do you have to do? You have to practice all day. You know that joke, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice. Look, if you have to explain the joke, you're in trouble. Well, if you're going to practice the violin 6, 8, 10 hours a day, are you going to be a good heart surgeon? No, because a heart surgeon too has to take care of business. So there are opportunity costs, and if you have your heart and mind and soul on the home, and if you're doing a disproportionate amount of homework, well, then it shouldn't be no accident that your productivity in the market, which is a very different thing, should be lower. It's as if you have the 50-pound sack on you. So, of course, you'll have lower productivity. There's another joke where the husband and the wife, they're both chemists. They both work in the pharmaceutical company. They come home at night at 6 o'clock. And what does the husband say to the wife? What's for dinner? Because he's not as good a cook as she is for various cultural or, I think, biological reasons, but we'll get to that in a bit. Another story is if the husband and wife both have a job in Auburn and one of them gets a great job offer in San Francisco and the other will just have to take what he or she can get, where are they more likely to move to enhance the husband's income or the wife's income? Obviously the husband's income, because the couple acts as if they're a profit-maximizing or wage-maximizing firm, and if they expect to have a baby, and they, or say three babies 3 years apart, starting in 3 years, by the time the youngest one is in kindergarten and the wife can then go back into full-time work, it'll be 15 years. So isn't it silly to move where the wife gets a job and the husband sort of has to, you know, drive a cab or be a waiter? You get the point? So the couple is acting, even if they have equal abilities, and even if they had equal attachment to the home, they're acting so as to maximize his income. So is it any wonder that his income would be higher, that his productivity is higher? That is the marital asymmetry explanation. Here's a quote with regard to housework. Two sociologists who were covered in the Newsweek. To their surprise, the sociologists discovered that the social and economic gains won by so many American women during the past decade have had remarkably little impact on the traditional gender roles assumed by the more than 3,600 married couples in their study. Although 60% of the wives had jobs, only about 30% of the husbands believed that both spouses should work, and only 39% of the wives thought so. No matter how large their paycheck, the working wives were still almost entirely responsible for the couple's housework. Husbands so hated housework, the researcher found, that wives who asked them to help out could sometimes sour the marriage. So this is a phenomenon that is true, as shown just by the survey here, that the overwhelming number of people, the marriage with which they are most familiar, the wife does the lion's share of the housework, the husband hardly does anything. Okay, I have two sets of proof of this, namely that it's the marital asymmetry hypothesis and differential productivity of husbands and wives that accounts for the pay gap and not prejudice on the part of employers. I have two sets of proof. The first set of proof is logical. The second set is empirical. First, let's just consider the logic of it. Now, what the feminists, the left-wing feminists, are asking us to believe is that the productivity of male and female is the same, and I'm assuming that the productivity is $10 an hour, and that the wage of the male is 10, and the wage of the female is 750, which would give you roughly the 25% wage gap that we're talking about. They're asking you to believe that this is an equilibrium situation. And if we do a profit analysis would be that the profit earned off of these workers is based on productivity minus the wage. Well, the profit of the male is 10 minus 10 or 0, which is fine. In equilibrium, there are no profits. But what's the profit from a female? Well, if the woman is equally productive at $10 an hour and you're paying her $7.50, you're making $2.50 an hour off of her. It's as if she has a little sign here on one of these little things that we've got saying, if you hire me, you make an extra $2.50 over hiring a man. Do you see that point? Well, anyone foolish enough to be a sexist pig and say, no, women belong, barefoot, pregnant, in the kitchen. None of them I'm going to hire ever because they're evil or inferior or whatever. And I'm only hiring men, and I'm paying them $10 an hour, and the women are just as good as the men in terms of productivity. But you can have them for $7.50. Well, you make an extra $2.50 off of each woman. You'll be able to underbid the counterpart male chauvinist pig employer and drive them out of business. Another implication of this is that in industries that are mainly dominated by men, forestry, mining, cement works, whatever, they'd make less profit than in industries where they could exploit women, right? Secretaries or librarians or whatever. But we know that profits in all industries have to be the same. Otherwise, there'll be movement of money to make them the same. If the profits in copper are higher than in steel, people will get into copper, lowering the profits, and out of steel, raising the profits until there's some sort of equilibrium. So this story is just nonsense on stilts, or, it's just crazy. It's just lunacy. It's illogical. I could say, who is that guy with the pointy ears? Star Trek? Spock. He would say, this is illogical. This can't be. Sometimes they say, well, let's have a legal minimum wage for men and women. If we did, this is called equal pay for equal work or something like that. Well, if we did, then we would pay men and women $10. The male productivity is 10, but now the female productivity is really 750, not because women are inferior, but because women have something else on their minds. They have a 50-pound sack on their back when it comes to working in the market. There's no biological inferiority, certainly not in the 20th or the 21st centuries, although there might have been one in the 18th and 19th centuries because of this upper body strength business. But if you do the profit analysis, you're going to lose money on women if you have to pay them 10 and they're only worth 750, and then women will be unemployed, just like teenagers are unemployed. So equal pay for equal work. You get equal pay for equal work in the market. It's just that women have less productivity because of their home and baby interests. So if you demand that they be paid the same amount and they're worth less on the market, they'll be unemployed. Because you're going to lose money if you hire a woman. Right now, the male and female unemployment rates are about the same. But if you had this stupid law, that would no longer hold. So much for the logic. Let me give you the empirical story, which is also a logical story. Because there's an implication of what I just said. The implication of what I just said, remember what I just said, is that marriage enhances male incomes and lowers female incomes. Well, what about people that have never been married? Not widowed people who've been touched by the institution of marriage, not divorced people, not separated people who've been touched by the institution of marriage, but people who have never been married. Not widowed, not separated, not divorced, not nothinged. Just never married. The implication of what I'm saying is that there, the wage gap should be zero, right? because I'm tying this whole thing on marriage. So therefore, if we abstract from marriage, and there are people that have never been married, the wage gap ought to go away. Well, let's look at the statistics. Female to male earnings in percentage terms. Total, 37. Ever married, 33. Never married, 99. Just look at the top one here. I'll get to the next in a second. This is a smoking gun for the hypothesis. It says that people who've been never married earn about the same amount of money. I got these statistics when I was working at the Fraser Institute in Canada, and the Statistics Canada, which is the equivalent of the Bureau of Labor Statistics in the U.S., didn't even calculate this stuff. We had to pay them tens of thousands of dollars to make a special calculation for us. And when they saw that, they didn't believe it and they didn't like it. But they gave it to us because we paid them for that. This is proof positive, if you believe in empirical proofs. I don't. I don't trust their statistics any more than I can throw them. I rely more on what I said was the logic of it. But it's nice to have the empirical evidence illustrate the point. Not prove it, but illustrate it. You see, the discriminatory hypothesis doesn't make sense. It's dead from the neck up. Because look, here I am, I'm a male chauvinist pig. I hate all women. I want to deprecate them. I don't distinguish between married and unmarried women, between widowed, separated, and divorced women. They're all women. And the hell with them. Right? That's my attitude. Well then, why am I discriminating against ever marrieds and not never marrieds? It doesn't fit. The rest of it is just more statistics. Here it's Canada, 1971, age 30 and above, ever married and never married. For a while, I was competing with Walter Williams and Thomas Sowell to see who could get the highest female-to-male ratio for never marrieds. They were doing it in the U.S., we were doing it in Canada. I'll take questions in a couple of minutes. Well, if you have a question on this, go ahead.
I notice it says earnings.
Yeah. You know, I don't remember offhand, but I took this from a publication of mine, so email me, say, where is this from, and then I'll give you the citation where I got it from. It's from Statistics Canada. I don't remember if it's weekly earnings, or I don't think it would be lifetime. It would be either weekly or annual or something like that. Okay, so here is another instance of people age 30 and above, ever married versus never married, and you see that here the never marrieds earn slightly more than the ever marrieds. See, when you're dealing with statistics, you don't get clarity. You're not going to get 1.0. It's going to always diverge a little bit. Sometimes the data is wrong. Sometimes, you know, it's surveys. You can't trust this stuff. Here is one where it's slightly lower, where the wage gap is only 6%. But when you get a wage gap of 6% as opposed to 30%, that's no gap at all. Here, what we did is instead of doing male and female, we took a proxy variable for ever married and never married. And what we said is people who are 16 to 24 versus people who are 25 and above, again, the female-male ratio. And look at the gigantic difference there. The idea here is that being 25 and above is a proxy variable for being ever married, because more people who are 25 and above have ever been married, whereas people 16 and 24, some of them have been married, but fewer. So we're saying a proxy variable for never married is being younger. Well, look at the gigantic difference in the wage gap. So it's just another way of indicating what's going on here. Okay. So to summarize this part of the talk, there is a wage gap. The reason that we have a wage gap has got nothing to do with prejudice or discrimination of any kind. The reason is different productivity levels. If it weren't different productivity levels, if they had the same productivity, anyone engaging in discrimination would lose money and go broke. So in the long run, in the marketplace, discrimination would be continually eroded and weeded out and presumably gone. Okay, now I'm going to get into the radical stuff, the glass ceiling. Why do we have a glass ceiling? Now, when Larry Summers asked this and he said that it's possible that male and female brains are different, he practically got fired as president of Harvard. Well, I'm going to go further than him. Happily, I won't get fired as president of Harvard because I'm not. But I'll go further than him and say it's not a possibility. This is a real good explanation for the glass ceiling biology, that women and men are very different biologically. How are they different biologically? Well, before I give you my analytic device, let me buttress the case that they are very different. First of all, let's take prisons. What percentage of men and women are in prisons? It's about 95% of all prisoners are men and 5% are women. Yes? What percent of male and females are in mental institutions? Again, the same sort of 95% of inmates in mental institutions are men and 5% are women. What percent of people are in cemeteries before their time? Now, obviously, at the end of the thing, all men and all women end up in cemeteries. But say if you were to look at 25-year-olds that are in cemeteries. Again, 95% of all 25-year-olds that are in cemeteries are men, whether it's from war or fighting or gangs or this or that. It's almost as if men... Okay, so that's on one side. And let me introduce this here. This is the glass ceiling. And what we have is a frequency distribution. And here we have something like IQ or ability. And I've now been describing A and B. And I've been saying, I should label this, this is men, males, and that's females. What I've been saying is that if you look at places over here, call it X1, that's prisons, cemeteries before their age, mental institutions, it's virtually all men and no women. Now let's look at X2. What's going on in X2? Well, let's take grandmasters in chess. It used to be before the Polgar sisters. Anyone into chess here? No. Before the Polgar sisters, three Hungarian sisters, the best grandmaster, and they have rankings of chess grandmasters, the best one was around 450th. The Polgar sisters, who came bursting into the chess world in the last 10, 20 years, are amazing. The worst of them is around 300th. The second best of the Polgar sisters was the 200th roughly ranked grandmaster, and the best of them I think was ranked 20th, or some ungodly high thing in history. Namely, in chess grandmasters, the men are 99% and the women are the 1%. Let's take Nobel Prizes. And I'm not talking about wishy-washy wussy fields like literature where they give it to females to even it out. I'm talking about physics and chemistry and even economics. In economics, there are no female Nobel Prize winners. In maybe Madame Curie is the only one that won in physics or any of the hard sciences. In math, they don't have any Nobel Prize, but they have some sort of field prize, and it's all men. So in terms of CEOs of companies, in terms of presidents of countries, okay, there was Indira Gandhi, and there was Golda Meir, and there was Margaret Thatcher, and there was this gal in Philippines. I forget her name, and that's about it. Gloria Arroyo. You know, four that I could name, and that's probably exhaust all the ones, unless I'm missing Liechtenstein or something like that. Virtually all the leaders, the CEOs, the math, the physics, the chess, are females, are males. It's almost as if males are God's or nature's crapshoot, And females are nature's or God's insurance policy. Females are all clustered toward the middle, right? There are very few females out on these tails. Whereas men are all over the lot. Now, I'm drawing these frequency distributions to accentuate the point I'm trying to make. They're not really derived from statistics, but I'm doing it so as to make it clearer. Namely, the women, the variance of women is very low. The standard deviation of women's abilities is narrow. They're all clustered toward the middle. There are very few outliers. Yes, every once in a while there's Lizzie Borden who kills someone, or there was this movie where you had some woman killing people. Very, very rare. Women are clustered in the middle. That's why we have a glass ceiling. Not because of prejudice or discrimination or capitalism being evil or anything like that. It's because women are God's or nature's insurance policy and men are his crapshoot. And in the crapshoot, some men get very, very good genes, and other men get very bad genes and end up in a bad way. The question to which I now want to address myself is, why is it that this is so? I hope I've convinced you that it is so. Yes?
What are women better at than men at this
time? Well,
this
means that there are a lot of women in the middle. In other words, that have average IQs or average abilities.
Oh, okay. Average.
Yeah, so these women over here are better than these men, right? So better means the x-axis. It's IQ or ability to, I don't know.
Yeah.
Now, in sports, it's interesting. If you look at the world's records in swimming and track and other things, shot putting, where you have distances, not basketball or things like that, because you have no objective criteria, men are better than women in every activity except one. There's one thing that women are better than men at, and it's got to do with sociobiology, and I'll give the hint away, and let me talk about sociobiology for a minute. The one thing that women are better than men at is ultra marathons, not 26 miles, but 260 miles. Races that take 24, 36 hours. Why is that? Why would women be better at something that takes 36 hours of not a continual struggle that, of running a quarter mile, but a marathon kind of struggle? Childbirth. Women have been picked on the basis of ability to bear children, because if they can't bear children, if they come from people who couldn't bear children, they wouldn't be alive in the first place. So women are better at stuff, that physical stuff that takes 24 hours because of childbirth, because sometimes childbirth takes 24 hours and you need to stick to it, whereas men haven't been selected on that basis. Okay, so let me go into a little bit of sociobiology. Sociobiology is the theory that we are the way we are now because of what it took to survive a million years ago. We are descended from people who liked babies, who were unhappy with crying babies and happy with happy babies. Because imagine another tribe just like us with the same ability, the same opposable thumb, the same IQ, only they didn't care about babies. What would have happened to them? They wouldn't have survived. Similarly with aggression. Males are much more aggressive than females. Any society composed of... who are those women warriors? What are they called? Amazons. Any Amazon society wouldn't have outcompeted our society. We come from a patriarchal society. Because an Amazon society that sent the women out to fight and allowed the women, to send them to hunt in the fight, and the women got dissipated. Look, the reason that the farmer keeps 50 cows in one bull and not 50 bulls in one cow is because men are superfluous after you got a few, right? You don't need that many men to impregnate all the females. But every time you lose a female, you lose population, and if you're having a competition between our patriarchal society and these other societies, we whop them because we consider men as cannon fodder, correctly. Germany and Russia had a war in World War II where they kicked the crap out of each other. At the end of that war, there wasn't a man between the ages of 20 and 50, or there were very few between 20 and 50 who were able-bodied. There were a few around. But they were enough to impregnate any woman that wanted to get impregnated. They must have had a grand time, but, you know, the society lasted. Now, suppose the war between the Nazis and the commies had been conducted by women, where men were mainly the bystanders, such that there were hardly a woman between 18 and 30 who was alive. There'd have been no next generation. Do you see why it is that women are much more important biologically than men? Okay, now, here is our society. I say our society is this way, and the proof of it is, let's take the opposite and show why that couldn't be. Sometimes this is an economic way of thinking. You want to prove something? Take its opposite and show why that's ridiculous. So, let's suppose that this is the female one and this is the male. Let's suppose that there was this other society a million years ago that was just as good as our society in terms of ability, in terms of inventing the wheel and all that stuff, and just as strong and smart as us. Only there, the men were the insurance policy. This is now the men, right? And the females are this group. Why are we whopping them? Well, the reason we're whopping them is, first of all these females over here are going into the grave. They're going into the caveman version of mental institutions, right? They're going, cemeteries, mental institutions, and jails. Namely, all of these women are knocked out of the box, right? So how can they outcompete us when almost half the women can't have babies? Or if they have babies, they kill the babies, right? Because they're incompetence or whatever it is that's on the left tail of the distribution. You see that? On the other hand, these women, the ones who were inventing the wheel and better spears and stuff, they're out hunting animals and they're getting decimated. You see why a society that's constituted that way would not compete with our society? Now look, I have a daughter. I don't much like this because I want her to win a Nobel Prize in something. She's a very bright girl. When she was in high school, she used to beat the nerd boys in math and physics. In college, she got great marks. She's now taking a PhD in neuroscience at Johns Hopkins, which is one of the best places. She's a very bright girl. Very, very bright. She explains to me what she's doing. I don't know what the hell she's talking about. Very bright girl. I'd love for her to, you know, win the Nobel Prize and all. And she has a chance, just a very small chance. Or there are very few girls that are that bright. So I'm not saying to the females in the audience, you know, don't try, don't strive, don't become a great Austrian economist or a great libertarian. I'm just saying the odds of a girl being the next Murray Rothbard are much less than a guy being the next Murray Rothbard. Because there are just so few people, so few females out there in the IQ of 180 or 200 or something like that. Very, very few. I don't much like it. It would be nicer in some way if it weren't that way. But I'm just trying to explain why we have a glass ceiling, not a grass ceiling, but a glass ceiling. And this seems to be an explanation of that. And with that, I stop and now call for questions.
I have two kind of concerns with the reasoning used in the presentation. The first concern, respectfully, and then the question section is second concern. The first concern, respectfully, is I think it leaves out the extent to which there was a real and clearly prohibitive presence in the 20th century because of sexism and discrimination, such that women weren't as likely to be able to get Nobel Prizes. I think the notion that to the extent that there was discrimination, it's probable that there was a barrier to entry, and consequently women, at least to this extent, can't be compared to men, nor can information be gleaned from, or inferences be gleaned perhaps from Nobel Prize data on the extent to which there was discrimination. The question's from the second issue.
Let me stop you with one, because we've only got 5 minutes and there are a lot of other people that have questions. You can maybe get the second question afterward. Let me make two comments. First of all, you don't have to be respectful. I mean, as long as you don't come and punch me out, you're bigger than I am, and as long as you're not nasty, I encourage people to ask sharp, acerbic questions. Namely, I'm putting forth very controversial views. It would be churlish of me to say, no, you have to treat me with kid gloves. What I want you to do is to take your best shot, intellectually, as you have been doing. So don't be apologetic and say, oh, you know, I'm trying to be easy on you or something like that. Now, my claim is that there never was any of this discrimination. There never was any of this stuff that we're alleging, racial or sexism or anything like that, because if there was any, the market would have eradicated it. Could there be some vestiges of it? Sure. The market is not perfect. But the market keeps grinding away at people who pay women lower than their productivity levels. So there was never any restrictions on entry or any of that stuff. Women, for many years, could go to law school or whatever or become a doctor. There were very few of them that wanted to be. So that would be my rough answer to the question. I'm not assuming it's perfectly competitive, but I'm assuming that there is a tendency in this direction, that the real reason women weren't doing as well as men is because of this, not because of any artificial whatevers, not because of culture, because culture emanates from biology. Lady behind you? Yeah. Go ahead. Pink top.
I was wondering, I've got a problem with assuming that there, with the word of discrimination might have come sooner, because discrimination is usually a really pejorative expression. And I was wondering for what the... You were asking about discrimination against women in the 20th century. If you couldn't say that it was just actually because people were more willing to get served by men than by women, so that it was mostly preference of the consumers instead of real discrimination, that could explain why women were less.
Well, there is some discrimination on the part of consumers, because when you go to a Chinese restaurant, most consumers want to have a Chinese waiter, even though you don't really need one, nor do you really need a Chinese chef, because surely Westerners can cook just as well as they if they just learn how to do it. It's just consumers want it. Similarly, with airplanes, it used to be that the stewardesses all had mini skirts, because the airplanes couldn't compete on the basis of price, so they started competing in terms of shortness of skirts and stuff like that. And most men want to go to Hooters or see women that are scantily clad and what have you. There is this stuff. I would say to some extent it vitiates in favor of women. I think it's only because of affirmative action that you have male... stewardesses, or what do you call them, flight attendants. If not for that, they'd all be female and they'd be young. And then they had ageist discrimination. Like, it used to be that you'd fire a stewardess after she got to be 30 or so. So you could always have young ones, because men want young women for socio-biological reasons. Imagine if there was a society, you know, every once in a while there'll be a newspaper thing about how actresses in their 50s can't get great actressing jobs anymore. Suppose sociobiologically there were a society, when they saw a woman in her 60s, they said, whoop-de-doo, you know, let me at her. And when they saw a woman of about 25, they said, you know, not ripe yet. How many babies would that society have? Not too many. The reason our males like a 25-year-old woman more attractive than a 65-year-old woman, and there are some 65-year-old women that are, you know, reasonably attractive, but men gravitate toward the 25-year-old, is because we descend from a tribe that like 25-year-olds, because if they like 60-year-olds, they're no longer around, because you can't have babies with them. So I would say that it's not because of this discrimination or anything like that, the wage gap. It's rather because of this sort of a thing. This young lady and then that man.
Yeah, if you take, like,
position like a professor where the productivity is subjective.
A service position like what?
Like if you're a professor.
Professor, yeah.
How would you justify the wage gap?
Well, it's interesting. Professors, there was this MIT case where the women in the physics department were moaning that their offices were smaller and the male physicists had bigger offices. But if you look at their publications, and their publications are supposed to be double-blind refereed, so you don't know who the sex of the author is, I would imagine, I haven't discovered this or I haven't examined this because there have been no statistics forthcoming, but I would imagine that all the female ones that were married had way fewer publications and lower quality publications than the males, because of this interest in the home and all. So what they don't ask, well, what are the publications of the men and the women? And we know in physics that most of the people in physics are males, and the ones that were the females, you have to assume are based on some sort of affirmative action. I mean, when Larry Summers was apologizing, he then said he's got a new program of $50 million to hire female scientists. Well, when he uses $50 million to hire female scientists, he's not going to take the best scientists who are male based on this sort of a thing. He's going to use affirmative action for females. Yes?
Could it be that the productivity law that you stated applies up until the margin of savings of the house is positive? I'm going to take 1 minute to explain myself. Hagenbrook, that's where my observation would be based. Guys, when they collect their paychecks on Friday, go and start drinking and playing cards and whatever and start throwing money. So what we've seen in Peru in the last 20 years is women entering the labor. Once they enter the labor, Cedric Paribus within the same job references, women are more productive than men. They go to their jobs at better times. They, within their jobs, they are harder workers. They do more boxes or whatever. And once asked why it was because they wanted to earn the money they needed in order to keep their households alive.
Well,
could it be that the productivity stays within as long as you have more savings? So, well, what the hell, I don't want to go and work because he's bringing more money into the house than the money I need to spend.
Well, all I can say is that if women are more productive, they'll be paid more. Oprah Winfrey is a black woman, and she's probably paid the highest, she's in the highest 0.1% of all wage earners. And the reason is she can put people in the stands, and she interests them, and they buy products that she endorses. Suppose I said, well, she's a black and a woman, and therefore I'm not going to hire her. I wouldn't be making much money. The guy who did hire her would make more money. So there can be exceptions. I'm not saying that there aren't women over here, and I'm not saying that there aren't high-paid women. I'm just saying on average, if you take all females and all males, you get rid of the outliers. It's already 5 minutes past the time. One last question.
It was actually just a comment, maybe an extension of what you said. You're talking about how minimum wage can hurt non-white teenage workers and they're more unemployed because of that. And I think that it's important to think about that because then it can hurt their productivity even more because they're not working as teenagers. And so then the next generation of non-white workers doesn't have as much of a chance. So it actually is the opposite. And that's the thing.
I agree with you. When we have things like the minimum wage law, it exacerbates these problems. Thanks for your attention.